May it please the court, I am Raymond Patachi, a member of the Virginia Bar. I'd like to introduce to the court Paul Allen Levy. He was admitted pro hoc vice in the court below and will argue the case for appellant.
Mr. Levy, where do you practice?
Washington, D.C., Your Honor.
Well, that's a short journey across the river. Welcome.
And then a little bit of traffic beyond that. May it please the court, my name is Paul Allen Levy, appearing this morning for Yale. The main issue before Your Honors this morning is what legal standards should govern Hadid's subpoena seeking to identify the authors of seven critical reviews that were posted on Yale in light of their First Amendment right to speak. And we urge the court to follow the rule that appellate courts of now 11 states, including the Kentucky case that we brought to Your Honor's attention yesterday, have decided. That is to say that the plaintiff has to make a showing of evidentiary merit, not just allegations, before it overcomes the right to speak anonymously. Now, in that regard, I want to make clear that we acknowledge that the anonymity that the Internet affords can be abused, and we don't suggest any absolute right to speak anonymously. But there are other cases where, as the Delaware Supreme Court said in the Cahill case, the plaintiff seems to be interested in little more than unmasking, and where the mere filing of the case has a chilling effect on the discussion, as noted in the study report that gave rise to Virginia Code Section 801-4071. And that's both because of the threat of unmasking and also because most people who post on places like Yelp can't afford the sustained defense of litigation. And plaintiffs know this. And so frequently they sue without necessarily having any intention of proving a case. And we cited several examples of that in the brief. Now, I want to emphasize we don't suggest that this plaintiff has sued in bad faith. But the standard has to be one that doesn't unduly encourage such litigation. We need a standard that works both for the well-intentioned plaintiffs and the plaintiffs who are less well-intentioned. That neither makes it too easy to hide behind pseudonyms by making it impossible to sue anybody who speaks anonymously, nor makes it too easy for the plaintiffs to unmask their critics simply by filing a complaint which, under principles of notice pleading, states a claim under some tort or contract theory. Because the chilling effect of a rule that makes it too easy to identify anonymous speakers is that it risks depriving the marketplace of ideas of useful information, and it skews the marketplace of ideas because nobody sues for defamation based on false positive reviews. Because of these concerns, what courts across the country have done is adopt a First Amendment balancing test that, on the one hand, gives the does a fair opportunity to defend their anonymity by providing for notice and making sure that particular information is given to the court, and then the plaintiff can't compel the identification of the speaker unless there's good reason to believe that the plaintiff can succeed on the merits of his case. First, you review the allegations to make sure it states a claim, and then you require the plaintiff to submit evidence in support of its claims, and the court can then balance the First Amendment right to stay anonymously against the right to seek redress for what are sometimes very grievous wrongs.
Can we do that within the context of the statute that we already have in front of us?
Right. Well, we think that the statute sets forth a procedure for putting forth before the court the information that it needs to make a decision. If you look at the study report that's provided in full at the joint appendix, what it says at page 262 is not that the proposed legislation would set a standard for deciding the constitutional issue, because the standard depends on whatever the constitutional and tort law are that apply to a particular case.
I have to smile because welcome from D.C. But on this side of the Potomac, we tend to look only at the study reports if the statute is in any way vague or we can't determine what the legislature is saying. And within 407.1, where do we do that balancing test that you're urging upon us?
Well, what the statute, let me read the language of the statute. The plaintiff must provide supporting material showing that one or more communications that are or may be tortious or illegal have been made by the anonymous communicator, or that the party requesting the subpoena has a legitimate good faith basis to contend the party is a victim of actionable conduct. Now, we think that the dendrite standard is entirely consistent with the standard set forth in the legislature, by the legislature in this statute, recognizing that our first argument is that the statute doesn't say if a plaintiff comes in, has no evidence to support its claim, but has valid allegations, facially valid allegations, you must enforce the subpoena. Now, if the statute said that, then there would be some inconsistency between our asking you to apply the First Amendment standard and the existence of the statute. The statute doesn't say that. It says the plaintiff must have supporting material, which to me implies evidence, making a showing, which to me implies evidence, that communications are or may be tortious. That's the early look principle, which the courts across the country have recognized as a constitutional requirement, or that the party requesting the subpoena, it's not enough to have a good faith basis to contend that there has been a tort. There has to be a legitimate basis for contending that there is a tort. And we think all this language rests comfortably with the First Amendment requirement that the courts in other states have recognized, that there has to be evidence of wrongdoing before you impose on the constitutional right to speak anonymously. So the statute, in our view, was not intended to supplant the constitutional analysis or to choose one approach to the Constitution. Legislatures don't choose approaches to the Constitution. That's really what courts do. But to provide a procedure for addressing the constitutional question by putting the necessary material before the court. Now, Hadid really tries to have it both ways. On the one hand, it tells you in its brief, Yelp is asking you to declare the statute unconstitutional, but at the same time it says the statute largely incorporates the dendrite rule with the one exception, according to Hadid, that there's no need to present evidence. But the statute never says that subpoenas have to be enforced with plaintiffs coming with no evidence, as I suggested before. There's no inconsistency between applying the constitutional requirement that courts across the country have recognized and what the Virginia legislature has commanded as the procedure for putting these materials before the court. And every court of appeals in the country that has addressed the issue has said that this is what the First Amendment requires. And indeed, given the fact that the First Amendment protects the right to speak anonymously, given the fact that the state must choose the least restrictive means for achieving the objective to be secured by disclosure, as not only the study report said, but the study report said it, citing this court's 1963 decision in NAACP versus Committee on Offenses, given the fact that a compelling government interest is required before the First Amendment right to take anonymously can be taken away. The Supreme Court of the United States said it in McIntyre, and this court said that that was a standard in the Committee on Offenses case. That in those circumstances, do mere allegations that anonymous reviewers made false statements without any evidence of falsity create a compelling state interest that warrants overriding the right to speak anonymously? We think not. Indeed,
well, counsel, let me ask you, in this case, what kind of evidence are you talking about?
Well, they claim, I have some skepticism, but they claim they were able to look at their customer database of 35,000 customers a year, that figure was given in the appellate brief below, and come to the conclusion that they weren't sure that these people were customers. Now, I wonder whether that's true, but maybe they can make a showing about the nature of their customer database that gives the court some confidence that that's true.
Well, absent that, what kind of evidence would you think would
it seems to me what they might have presented is averments that staff who go to homes never charge more than the advertised price. Perhaps they have procedures within the company to make sure that staff toe the line with respect to the coupon offers that they put in the newspapers, quality control measures that would give them confidence that the averment, that the claim on Yelp that certain members of the staff didn't recognize the coupons or get charged more than the coupons provided, that those statements are unlikely to be true. Maybe that's kind of evidence they could put in. They could have evidence about their advertising practices.
Would it have to come in as evidence? What if such averments were in the complaint itself?
Well, I think if there were a verified complaint. This complaint is very conclusory. The averments that were made, for example, in the Alvis Coding case in the Western District of North Carolina, which applied a Dendrite or Cahill-like standard, and there you had a detailed affidavit explaining how statements about the company were false. But if these are statements about the plaintiff, you'd think the plaintiff would have evidence of the falsity. As if it's logical to believe that they ought to have evidence about the falsity, it's perfectly reasonable to ask them to supply the evidence before you impose on the defendants. You have a question.
Yeah, counsel, you mentioned that the complaint was conclusory, and the complaint leaves something to be desired. And you actually raised that issue to the Court of Appeals in your assignment of error number one. And then that assignment of error, though, is not present before us. Can we reach the issue in this case of the conclusory nature of the complaint?
Is that
issue before us?
I made the issue about the conclusory nature of the point of the complaint in response to your question about, does there have to be evidence? And my response was, you could have a verified complaint, which we don't in this case. I was making the point about the conclusory nature of the complaint only to suggest that even if this complaint had been verified, it seems to me that it would not have been sufficiently specific to warrant about the nature of the falsity that's claimed to overcome the First Amendment right to speak anonymously.
With statutes and rules virtually everywhere that require pleadings to be done in good faith, are you sure that you need to have a verified complaint to satisfy this?
Given the fact that you're taking away a valuable First Amendment right and that you need a compelling state interest to do so, I think you need more than the presumption that people will file complaints in good faith, not subject to sanctions, that applies to every case. But before you impose on a First Amendment right, you ought to require more than that. You don't give relief in case, you wouldn't give a preliminary injunction based on the assumption that the complaint was filed in good faith. And this is a kind of relief. When you tell the plaintiff who its critics are, you enable the plaintiff, and maybe not in their circumstances. It's hard to imagine what a rug cleaning company could do to anonymous critics.
Well, to be sure, there are all these cases that you cite. Do any of them require verified pleading?
The cases all require evidence. It may be in the form of a complaint, or it may be in the form of affidavits, but they all require evidence.
All right.
And so that's my reliance there. So these are all things, I said, the various things that Hadid could put in, or maybe they have evidence about the nature of their database and why the court should be comfortable believing that there's a sufficient basis based on the customer database for overcoming the right to speak anonymously. But it should not be sufficient. If any merchant can get the identities of its critics by doing what Hadid Carpeting has done here, just by saying that it can't figure out which customers made a given criticism, even if the criticism is one that customers consistently make, then there will be no more right to speak anonymously in Virginia.
Counsel, have you filed a demurrer to this complaint?
I don't think we would have standing to do so. We raised the First Amendment interest.
Got it.
Companies often believe that no real customer would criticize them. But sad to say, that's not true. If the mere belief that no real customer would make a criticism is enough to justify stripping the critics of the right to speak anonymously, many consumers may be intimidated from expressing their opinions candidly, excluding their information from the marketplace of ideas. And the record here makes clear that some two-thirds of the Yelp reviews of Hadid carpet cleaning are highly negative, most of which Hadid does not claim are false because these are from people who are not customers. I'd like to say a word briefly about the subpoena jurisdiction issue before I reserve the hopefully last few minutes of my time. The subpoena jurisdiction is well presented in the briefs, but as I was preparing for argument today, I couldn't help but be struck by the pervasive assumption in the study report that's in the joint appendix that cases, subpoenas to AOL had to be litigated in Virginia because AOL was here, just as, for example, subpoenas to Yahoo had to be litigated in Santa Clara County, California, because Yahoo is located there. You'll see this at page 238 of the study report and 244 of the study report. In fact, 244 of the joint appendix is particularly interesting because it sets forth the study resolution, which was passed by the legislature, to get the study report done. It said that these cases are being heard here in the Commonwealth, cases that are being litigated elsewhere, because the Internet service providers are located here. Now, I think that represents a legislative recognition of the general rule that subpoenas to out-of-state companies have to be made in the state where they're located and where the documents are located.
Well, it may very well just reflect that the only case that was outstanding at the time was AOL versus Anonymous Publicly Traded Company, and those people actually proceeded under the Uniform Deposition Act, which required exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly.
But it's not necessarily a policy decision of the legislature, it's just simply the basis of that case's determination.
My point is that the legislature recognized what the regular procedure was, and now the shoe's on the other foot. Now it's a California company that doesn't want to be burdened, and one of the things that the study report talks about at page 265 is that you want to avoid putting a burden on the Virginia ISPs to litigate the confidentiality of their business records in other states. Now it's a California company that doesn't want to be burdened by having to litigate the confidentiality of its business records. And it's not just responding to the subpoena. You have to hire a lawyer. Sometimes you have to bring expert witnesses. Yep, I'm sorry. You
That's
have
okay. I'm trying to think through the three cases that you cited from Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana found that there was no jurisdiction because you couldn't enforce a contempt order. Were all three of them along those lines?
Well, I think they all said that there's no subpoena jurisdiction, that jurisdiction is different from process.
Understood. And but the reason why you had no subpoena jurisdiction was that you could not enforce your subpoena.
Well, because there was no jurisdiction. I mean, there is jurisdiction. If I may, you can serve the registered agent of any out-of-state corporation and therefore get court power over that corporation by serving the registered agent. There's no question of that. But the question of whether you have jurisdiction over the corporation is a different question. If service were enough, you
would even... Those courts based the lack of jurisdiction on no ability to enforce, did they not?
On the lack of jurisdiction to enforce. And if service of process were enough, you wouldn't need a long-arm statute. You would have general personal jurisdiction over every corporation that has a registered agent in this state. You wouldn't need to look to the long-arm statute. You could say, we've served process on the registered agent. They're here. That's enough.
Yeah, you haven't answered my question, right. But it's apparent you're not going to.
So I think they relied on the lack of jurisdiction. They said subpoena
jurisdiction. What was the basis for the lack of jurisdiction? Was it not the inability to enforce?
No, I don't think that's correct.
What was it?
I think it was that there's no jurisdiction over companies because the rule is that you...
The basis for lack of jurisdiction cannot be that there is no jurisdiction.
There's no statute giving jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to reserve the balance of my...
You have 1 minute and 10 seconds.
May it please the court, my name is Rennie Delaney. I represent the appellee Hadid Carpet. This case is about the right to personal security, specifically the right to the unfettered enjoyment of one's reputation. And what the appellants would have the court forget is what it said in the Gazette case, that society has a pervasive and strong interest in preventing and redressing attacks upon reputation. If I might, I'll cover the standard of review, the Virginia test, and how Hadid Carpet met it, and the subpoena to Yelp's registered agent in that order.
Counsel, at some point I would like for you to touch upon whether what happens if your complaint is insufficient as a matter of law. because you have all anonymous defendants, no one has had the opportunity to file a demurrer at this point. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Should the judge determine before even hearing the subpoena argument whether your complaint would be sufficient to survive a demurrer? Because I have serious doubt that it would.
Thank you, Your Honor. The defendants in this case have been given notice of the complaint through Yelp and notice of the subpoena.
But so, as counsel indicated indirectly in response to my question, they would have to actually make a general appearance in order to file a demurrer, would they not?
In some courts, anonymous defendants have entered an appearance as an anonymous person. So I suspect that they might try that first.
I don't think that would work in Virginia.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're probably right. Needless to say, they might try.
Okay.
And the second point is, no one has filed a demurrer, so, one might surmise whether it would...
But Yelp can't. Yelp's answer was correct. They would have no standing. They're non-party. They would actually have to seek to be joined in order to file a demurrer.
I believe that's correct. They cannot be sued under the Communications Decency Act, so we could not sue Yelp directly. The statute 8.01.407.1 gives Yelp standing to object to the subpoena, but not to necessarily defend.
And Justice Lemons really hit the nail on the head. If you have the opportunity to argue a demurrer for the trial judge to consider a demurrer, then the trial judge is able to determine, was this complaint made in good faith? And if it wasn't made in good faith, then you have a party before the court who can file under 8.01.271.1.
Well,
right now the challenge that we have is that no one has yet tested this complaint. If it's wholly without merit, then you never reach the subpoena issue. And so, how would the trial judge be? Would we be on solid ground in saying that the judge should or shall look first to the underlying merits of the four corners of the complaint before even reaching a hearing on the subpoena?
Well, I think you go too far, because the second element of the statute says that the judge has to determine whether the communications are tortious or that there's a legitimate good faith basis for filing the suit. So, as part of that, Yelp is able and did come in and make several objections to what they believe is the problem with the complaint, one of which, namely, was they wanted us to somehow aver or prove the truth that we never cheated anybody in Virginia at any time. I don't really think that that's required under the pleading standard, but to be specific to your point, Yelp raised those objections at the trial court. The trial court had to necessarily deal with them under the second element of the test. So had the judge simply said, I don't think that you've laid forth a proper case, the judge would have quashed the subpoena, and then I would have no one to sue. That's exactly what happened in the Gilo case recently in Fairfax Circuit Court, where the judge found that the statements in question were rhetorical hyperbole and therefore could never be actionable. And that's why, in that case, the judge found that the second element wasn't met. So, you don't necessarily have to rule on a demurrer in order to address the question of whether or not the statements are actionable, or whether or not there's merit to the complaint. It's required as part of the statute.
Do you believe the statute permits the judge to actually take evidence, hear testimony, and take evidence in terms of the subpoena hearing?
No, the statute has the second test. It's the second factor. It's a two-part test. The statements either have to be proven to be tortious, or you have to show the legitimate good faith basis as to why you brought the specific complaint.
But can the judge, under that statute, hear testimony and take evidence in order to make that determination?
I think that it would be up to his discretion whether or not to go that far. I don't think that he's required to.
Okay.
Well, at the very least, it ought to be demonstrated by the pleading, though, shouldn't it?
I think that, that you start with the pleadings, for example, and then, Yelp, there's other things, like Yelp put in affidavits. So to address specifically, our case, if you look at Yelp's posting requirements, you can only post if you are a customer, and that's an important fact. Yelp prides itself, and even its affidavit states that they decide which reviews are reliable and which reviews are not reliable. So when you look at a Yelp review, you know, you're coming to the, you're looking at that with the idea that Yelp has determined that this review is reliable or not.
Well, and surely, you don't believe in this day and age that every poster is a customer, do you?
Well, of course not. And I mean, I wasn't cited in the briefs, but there was a recent press release from the New York Attorney General who said 14% of all online reviews are fake. So, no, I do not believe that they're all accurate. But my point is that, you know, if we look at our specific reviews, Yelp filtered 81 of the 89 reviews, meaning Yelp deemed them not to be reliable, including all seven of ours. So when you look at the actual statements that we put into the complaint, you can also look to see for each specific poster certain data, how many other posts did they make about other companies. And four of them, this was their only post whatsoever. And then another one was from New Jersey, where we don't do business. Another one, it appeared to us that it posted under the same comment under two different names. And one had multiple posts, but zero friends as indicators. So it's not just the statement; it's the circumstances surrounding the statement. And our circumstances are: Yelp says these people are customers if we post them. Yelp determined that these specific reviews were not reliable, and there are other indicators as to those reviews as to why we would say they're not reliable. And if you take two cases, the Fodor case out of Nevada and the Gilo case out of the Fairfax Circuit Court, where you're looking at trial judges trying to make a decision. The circumstances and the situation for each post matters, and that's why the post in the Fodor case were about how this company had committed a fraud, and the court said, "Hey, we're going to allow that person to be unmasked." And in the Gilo case and the Fairfax Circuit Court recently, the court said these statements are not actionable, and therefore you're not going to prevail against this defendant, and therefore that's the end of it.
Let me look at the Dendrite momentarily. As I understand your brief, you aver that the only difference between 8.01, 417.1, and Dendrite is that in Dendrite, the New Jersey court required admissible evidence to be adduced. And your response to my earlier question about the statute indicated your belief that the statute allows admissible evidence to be adduced if the judge orders it. Have I fairly stated your position?
Yes, and for one of the reasons that's why I brought my client to the court that day in case the judge wanted him to take the stand.
So if we were to just simply graft in a Dendrite test, with the only difference being that under our current statute, you're not required to adduce evidence, instead you're allowed to adduce evidence. What would your objection to that be?
I don't know why it would be necessary. I mean, the statute is...
We do some things that aren't necessary. Would the statute prohibit us from... I mean, I'm relying upon your brief. Would the statute prohibit us from adopting Dendrite light?
Well, I think the General Assembly has set forth what they believe are the six factors. I don't think that there's any policy justification to disregard the General Assembly's viewpoint.
We would never disregard the General Assembly. Now, I'm relying upon your brief, which I believe indicates that the difference between our statute and Dendrite is the requirement for admissible evidence. Have I misinterpreted your brief?
No, I think the problem I'm having difficulty with your question is that, I mean, I think we're on the same page. You want to simply say that second factor actually requires an evidentiary hearing, and that test...
Well, that's what Dendrite would require. And you indicated that the judge could have that, but he doesn't have to.
I believe the Dendrite requires a prima facie case be made under the motion to dismiss standard. It's the Doe versus Cahill test, which requires the summary judgment standard. So I guess the problem there is I don't necessarily agree that an evidentiary hearing is required under Dendrite. I think that it doesn't necessarily have to be. You just have to have the proof, whether it's in your complaint or whether it's supported by affidavits. I think that that's my understanding of dendrite.
Okay.
It's, well, a higher, it's statute, a higher standard than
our statute uses the word showing. What's the difference?
Well, it's what you have to show. I have to show a legitimate good faith basis, which is a lesser standard than the motion to dismiss standard, and it's certainly a lesser standard than the summary judgment standard. So I think we're all talking about one the same thing. Something has to be provided, but then what level does the court look at it? In Virginia, it's a legitimate good faith basis. In dendrite, it's prima facie case or motion to dismiss or demur. And in Doe versus Cahill, it's summary judgment. So the question there is what level, what, how do you want to ratchet the test for the circuit judge to decide how much of a gatekeeper am I going to be? I say that I like the Virginia test, which is legitimate good faith basis.
But a legitimate good faith basis can be proved in many different ways. One could say the only way you can prove that is through testimony. The only way you can prove that is through affidavits. The only way you can prove that is through evidence of some type.
Well, I think that, you know, the statement itself can certainly say a lot. So if the statement says, you know, I don't like the governor because I don't like his hair, that's not necessarily ever going to be an actionable statement. On the other hand, I don't like this person, this lawyer, because he cheats his clients and takes their money. Now you're talking about a different level of statement. So that's, you know, that's one level of analysis. So if you look at the Gilo case, they were making rhetorical comments about the lawyer's appearance. The judge there said, that's not going to be defamation. In our case, you have very specific instances of where someone has said that Hadid Carpet has defrauded or cheated somebody. That puts us over into the Fodor area where, you know, if someone is saying that you are lying and cheating to your clients, you have an actionable case for defamation per se. That should survive even the dendrite standard. So, you know, my difficulty with that is when I can show you the actual statement, I attach it to the complaint, that's physical evidence, and you can look at the statement and decide whether or not it could ever be defamatory. What else do you need except that you come into this area where you say, well, can you prove it really wasn't a customer? Now, where we go to meet legitimate good faith basis on that is to say that we've reached out to these people. It's not simply that, you know, as he says, that we checked our database. We attempted to reach out to them. They tried to figure out who these people were. They were unable to
stop. Let me stop you there for a second, because you were saying that, you know, there are certain statements that one knows to be defamatory just by looking at them, right?
I think that's
what you're saying. Well, what about statements that are not necessarily defamatory because they could very well be true? Are you saying that that's something the court should look at? Because my understanding in this particular instance, your position is not that the statements are necessarily untrue. It's just that it would be improper for someone who's not a customer to make those statements because it would not be true in their instance.
Well, that's why I'm advocating for the lowest standard, which is legitimate good faith basis. You know.
But then doesn't that mean that you can always ask that? So I can't. Somebody says something bad about me, and I don't know whether or not they're a customer. So the only way I can find out is for you to tell me who said it.
Well, I might have other ways of finding out. So, for example, I've had a lot of people from around the country come to me, and this is what they'll say. I can go through my list, and I know who this person is. I know who that person is. I know what their complaint is, but I may not know who this person is. So these businessmen are not necessarily looking to go out and sue people for no reason at all. They have to have they need to have, under the law, a legitimate good faith basis. They need to convince a lawyer that there's a legitimate good faith case.
The one that they're paying, or some other lawyer?
Well, I guess, you know, it depends on which lawyer you hire, but I'm a Virginia lawyer, and I believe in everything that you said at the start of this, when you were swearing the new lawyers in.
You can believe that, but I don't see what that has to do with.
It has to do with when I'm coming into court, signing my name, I've investigated all of these steps, and what I'm saying about an investigation being done, it was done. What I'm saying about trying to reach out to the people, some people were offered a
let's talk about just like the investigation. I couldn't tell what the investigation involved. I mean, from looking at the record. And you said there was an investigation. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, that was a criticism that he has, that we didn't detail and say, well, we, you know, typed in YB into the computer, and, you know, or RSP in Haddonfield, New Jersey, and we didn't get an RSP in Haddonfield, New Jersey.
Right, well, somebody signs it, Cheshire Cat. Like, we checked our list, we don't have a client named Cheshire Cat. Well, you know, evidently we need to sue these people and find out who really said
that. Well, that's a factor. It's not the dispositive one. But the fact remains that these people lie or hide their names and their actual location. So we're not dealing with people that are coming forward and saying, you know, my name is Rennie Delaney from Arlington, Virginia. They're hiding their names. They're hiding their addresses. There's only so far you can take your investigation when you're dealing with people that are hiding who they are. So, you know, you're only going to go to this effort, to this trouble, when the statements are so troubling that you feel that they're damaging your business and you have no other recourse. Once your reputation is tarnished, that's the problem. Now,
I guess the piece of puzzle that I'm honestly trying to figure out is, say, for instance, like, you've got an example, one of my recollection, one of the people you're trying to amass says that I had an Afghan rug that they shrunk and then they tried to stretch it, et cetera. You certainly can check your records to see, do we have a customer whose Afghan rug we shrunk about this time? And did they come back in and did we try to stretch it? And did we give them a 20% discount? I mean, certainly you could check your records to see whether you have a customer that fits that description, right?
Yeah, so that's my recollection was that was done at the time. And I brought Mr. Hadid to the hearing and had the judge, you know.
But, of course, the judge never heard about whether it was done or not.
Well,
I couldn't tell from looking at the record that had been done.
Well, it's not in the record. You're right.
Okay. I wonder.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. But I'm saying it's one factor of many to consider. I'd like to make one quick point. You know, what is the minimum?
Quick question after you make your point.
Okay. So, you know, what is the minimum constitutional floor here? And I refer you to the Gazette case again. So long as the states do not impose liability without fault, they may define for themselves the appropriate standard of liability for a publisher or a broadcaster. And I think that the point here to make is that the Virginia General Assembly has chosen a standard that is higher than strict liability for the purposes of obtaining information under a subpoena. So I don't think there's any question that this particular test is unconstitutional. And I'll take your question, sir.
Okay. And frankly, when you're dealing with anonymous posters, I mean, that's one of the higher constitutional values we have. That goes all the way back to Thomas Paine and common sense. But here's my issue for you. When it comes to jurisdiction, the two of you are as far apart as it's possible to be. And we have to decide which of you is right. He says, no jurisdiction whatsoever. You say, of course there's jurisdiction. When it comes to the test, once we get beyond the jurisdictional hurdle, if we do, when it comes to the test, I'm not hearing that you are as far from Yelp's position as I thought. Yelp's position is adopt Dendrite. Your position seems to be, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the court as a floor, the trial court as a floor, simply has to have the same test it would have in any other discovery dispute, and that is there a good faith basis for filing this subpoena? But that the court under this statute can go higher, that it has the ability, the discretion to go higher. And it can take evidence. It can require require or accept an affidavit. It can hear testimony. Am I correct?
Yes, because I agree with the words good faith. You have to put the word legitimate in front of good faith.
But legitimate good faith applies to every single discovery device filed at any time in the Commonwealth. You cannot file a discovery device without a legitimate good faith basis.
Well, I don't necessarily see that in the word legitimate in other places. So the way I interpret it was that
rather than parsing whether it's possible to have illegitimate good faith, what I'd like to ask is this: what if a court were to say, "I have discretion under this statute, and I have decided that in this court, because of the importance of anonymous speech, I am going to require a Dendrite standard in this case, in this court today. Statute doesn't force me to do that, but that's what I, as a trial judge, would choose to do." Has that trial judge abused his or her discretion?
May I answer the question?
Absolutely.
To the extent that he wants to impose the Dendrite factors, If you look at the abuse of discretion, what does it mean? It means that you're considering a factor that you shouldn't, or that you didn't consider a factor that you should have, or that on the whole your judgment is clearly wrong. So to the extent that a judge is taking a factor or a standard of proof, say, for example, the Dendrite standard of motion to dismiss, and that's a higher standard than has been provided by the statute, which is legitimate good faith, then yes, I think that judge would have abused his discretion. Now, so that's the simple answer to your question. The standard itself is really what's at issue, and how the plaintiff addresses and reaches the legitimate good faith standard as opposed to some higher standard, I don't think that's negotiable. But
okay, I appreciate that answer.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have three brief points that I would like to make, and I don't know if I get extra time because he had extra time, but I hope I can fit within a short time. First of all, he had
extra time because we had a very active bench. Let's see if you have one.
Okay. the statute, Mr. Delaney conceded that a trial judge has discretion to require evidence in a particular case, but not to, quote, impose the Dendrite standard. But it seems to me that if he's conceded that a trial judge has discretion to require evidence in a particular case, there's no inconsistency between our argument that Dendrite is what the First Amendment requires and what the statute provides. Because if a trial judge has discretion to require evidence in a particular case, it cannot be that the statute does not permit a requirement of evidence as a matter of First Amendment law. Second, Mr. Delaney told you a great deal of things about the basis for believing that the post did not come from customers, and none of them related to the customer database. These are new arguments that I've heard for the first time this morning. Now, if you adopt the Dendrite standard or some other constitutional standard, as he has conceded effectively that the statute allows, he will have the opportunity to make all those points on remand. He will have the opportunity to present the evidence that he decided not to present when he chose not to put Mr. Hadid, who's also in the courtroom this morning, presumably not to testify. He will have the opportunity to put Mr. Hadid or an affidavit forward to show the basis for believing that these people aren't customers. But you should not allow a merchant to take away the right to speak anonymously just by vaguely stating that he has a belief that they might not be customers, and therefore I need to know who they are in order to find out that fact for my own interests.
Thank you for your argument. Call the next case.